You're listening to a UC San Diego podcast.
Okay. How's it going?
Welcome to the last class before assignment two is due. Sorry, assignment one. Assignment two isn't due just yet. Things are getting pretty exciting. Congrats to the data or data musketeer for being in position one for the rating prediction task. I know a lot of people are struggling to get this sort of latent factor model working, which is kind of how I suggested solving this. And you can see that on the leaderboard, it's really fighting at the margins here. It's all coming down to the fourth decimal place. And this kind of keeps happening all the way down the leaderboard until position 100 and 113, all right? So Captain Clueless is doing something that Kevin isn't, all right? I assume that's a latent factor model and that this isn't. Maybe I'll be proven wrong and these people are all finding some flaw in my data set that I just didn't realize. But there's clearly kind of two classes of solution here. These are the people who have come up with the best version of some slightly simpler model, and everyone above them has basically figured out the solution, whatever it is. They're all doing basically the same thing as each other. So find out what they're doing and see if you can belong to that group. I don't think the marking scheme will be too strict in terms of fourth decimal places and so forth, other than some minor prize to whoever is on top for the private leaderboard. Okay, so the other task, the healthfulness prediction task, Hoop Feast 420 is on top. Hoop Feast 420 is not the winner. Winners don't do drugs. So currently, Ren Jiang Yan is the real winner. There was some the private test data was obtained, the hashing function was reverse engineered, so on and so forth. The student tried to delete their account. It turns out you can't delete your account from Kaggle. I can't delete it either. I'm not a Kaggle administrator. So unfortunately, this has to stay here for now. But, you know, this is where you want to be. This is the sort of highest legitimate solution you can achieve. So best of luck with that in the remaining 30 or so hours before it's due. Okay, so I'll talk a little bit about assignment two at the end of the lecture. I'm sure nobody is too excited to really start on assignment two just yet. But you might at least want to start thinking about forming a team, thinking about what kind of data set you want to work with, what kind of application or task you found the most interesting in this class that you want to work on for your assignment. So we'll get to that soon. Is everyone happy? Any questions about assignment one that are really bothering people? No? One thing I know that people have been getting a bit stuck on with this helpfulness prediction task is that they've trained some model. They get great test performance, they get good validation performance, so you get great train performance, good validation performance, and then it doesn't work at all when they upload it to Kaggle, and they're kind of worried that their solution won't be good on the private fraction of the leaderboard. So I can kind of tell you the reason this is happening is just because of this evaluation measure being sensitive to outliers. Okay, so I think somebody noticed the top most voted on review is something like a 50 Shades of Grey review or something like that, with thousands upon thousands upon thousands of helpfulness votes. So getting that one wrong counts for thousands of times more than getting one that only had one vote. So the error measure is very, very sensitive to these outliers. And this is especially a problem if at training time you're optimizing something like the mean squared error rather than the mean absolute error, which isn't quite the same thing. Because you're going to be overfitting based on those outlying reviews. So you're going to say, well, at training time, all I want to do is make those extreme outliers happy, So good features are ones that accurately predict the helpfulness rate for those reviews that received thousands of votes. And, you know, they're extreme outliers. So if you ever fit those outliers, your solution's not necessarily going to work well for whichever other outliers there are in the seen or the unseen proportion of the test data. So if you want to fix that issue, you've kind of got to treat those outliers with a little bit more care. In fact, the simplest way to treat them with more care is just to throw them away. So one thing you might try is just to delete these outliers from your training set so that you can't overfit them. But, you know, something maybe a bit more complicated along those lines is how you might try to avoid having this very random behavior on the seen or the unseen portion of the data, which is essentially being determined by outliers. Anything else people are stuck with? I think most of the solutions look pretty good so far. Okay, so on to social networks. So we've already looked at social networks a little bit, going right back to week 3, when we looked at clustering and community detection. So we saw ways we could essentially summarize the structure of networked data. Not particularly social networks, but just adjacency matrices in general, whether it was protein-protein interactions or citations or friends on Facebook or whatever. We tried to come up with these community detection algorithms, which are kind of taking a sort of compression-like view of a network and saying, can we take this very high-dimensional adjacency matrix and summarize its structure in the sense that we can replace the high-dimensional matrix with some small number of communities such that we'd be able to recover the adjacency matrix as accurately as possible. So it's a very sort of compression-like notion of modeling a network or modeling an adjacency matrix. What we're looking at this week is how can we model social networks in particular? So networks of how humans interact with each other. How do these differ from other types of networks? You know, how do people form friendships? What are the sort of paths between people? How do people share information or networks? Things like that. So how can we build good models of network formation that are specifically tailored to the structure of social rather than other types of networks? So really, what do social networks look like? So one property of a social network is this idea of a power law. So power law on a network basically says sort of the one percenters of social networks, right? There are a few people who have all the friends and a lot of people who have not that many friends. And this is true of things like the web graph. There are a few pages that receive all the links and lots of pages that have hardly any links going to them. It's somewhat true of something like a power grid. There are a few substations that are kind of hubs that receive all of the links or generate all of the links, and there are many, many power stations that have few. It's true of a social network like Flickr as well. There are a few people who have loads and loads and loads of friends. They're very popular, and then loads more people who have relatively few friends. Okay, so power laws are sort of one characteristic of social networks in particular that may not be true of other types of network. Something else is this idea of a hub or authority in a network. So this is the notion that in a social network there might be some actors who are particularly influential or authoritative. So in this is a network of mathematical co-authorships. There's one very influential actor here who's Paul Erdős. So the story goes that Paul Erdős, he's this famous mathematician, he'd walk around to other mathematicians' houses, knock on their door, say, you know, can I sleep on your couch for 2 months? I'm not going to pay rent, but we can write a paper together. And this is how he formed this huge network of collaborations with other famous mathematicians. So somehow, Paul Erdős is an authority in mathematics, but he's not just an authority because he wrote loads of papers. He's an authority because he wrote loads of papers with other authoritative mathematicians. So we'll kind of talk about this self-referential notion of influence. A good mathematician is one who co-authors papers with good mathematicians. A good web page is one that receives links from other good web pages. A popular person is somebody who is friends with popular people. So this kind of self-referential notion can be used to define authority in a network, and that's how algorithms like PageRank are developed. Similarly, we have this idea of a small world phenomenon. You may have played this game called 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon. Who's heard of this? Everyone? Yeah. Three people. It's a very fun game. I can't really play it because I don't know enough about movies, but your challenger will name some actor, like Kevin Spacey, and you have to trace a path back to Kevin Bacon based on movies people have acted in together. So Kevin Spacey was with Jack Lemmon in Dad. Jack Lemmon was with Kevin Bacon in the film JFK. So Kevin Spacey has a Bacon number of 2, right? It's a fun game. But the point is, social networks in particular exhibit what's called a small world phenomenon. So there do exist these short paths between people. Pick any two actors, you can trace a path between them through collaborations that is very, very short. So this need not be true of networks in general, but it happens to be true of social networks. So we'd like to kind of characterize what is the model of how networks form that exhibits this type of structure. Why does this happen? So these are the kind of things we'll look at. We'll look at a couple of simple models of network structure. We'll look at this idea of a power law and how we can come up with a random model of network formation that exhibits a power law structure. Probably on Wednesday, we'll look at this idea of triadic closure and the strength of weak ties. So there's a very, this is a very nice, kind of unintuitive but cute idea. So last time you found out about a job opportunity or something, did you find out about it through a close friend or did you find out about it through an acquaintance? And usually people will answer they found out about it through an acquaintance. And this is kind of surprising in the sense that you would think, well, my friends ought to be helping me find jobs. But on the other hand, acquaintances somehow, they connect you to a distant part of the network. So they have access to information that you don't have access to. So this is the idea of the strength of weak ties. So acquaintances are somehow exposing you to novel information in a network. Then we'll look at this small world phenomenon, this idea of 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon and why that, you know, what's a model of network formation that explains why that property arises. And if we have time, which maybe we won't, I'll talk about algorithms like PageRank that use this sort of self-referential notion of authority or influence in network to find sort of hubs or influential individuals. All right, so until now I've been giving out these chapter references from Bishop for everything in this class. I assume no one bought the textbook, right? Anyone? No? Anyway, well, it's very expensive, so I forgive you. But at least for this topic, there is a free textbook which is just dedicated to studying the structure of networks. Here's a link to it. Really, I'm only spending 1 week covering this very huge topic. There are other classes, maybe I'll teach one day, that are spending an entire quarter or entire semester just analyzing the structure of human social networks. Okay? So this is really just the tip of the iceberg. Okay, so we'll start with a couple of definitions before we try to define some simple random models of network formation. You know, we remember the node degree, so number of edges incident on a node, and we can be a bit more complicated and say, let's talk about the in degree and the out degree separately. So the out degree is how many, okay, the in degree is how many links the node receives, so 2 in this case. The out degree is how many links the node forms. So 1, 2, 3, 4. All right? That's one definition. The other definition, connected components, we remember that from week 3. We say 2 nodes belong to the same connected component if they're reachable from each other. We can kind of collapse this into two notions. One is strongly connected components. So if A is reachable from B and B is also reachable from A, then they will belong to the same strongly connected component. So all of these, any pair of nodes belonging to the same strongly connected component here would be reachable, would be mutually reachable from each other. And the more, the weaker notion, which is a weakly connected component, which just says, if we forget about the directness of each edge, which nodes are still reachable from each other. Okay, that's all we need. Two definitions, node degrees, connected components. We can come up with a very, very simple model of network formation. So what we'd like to do over the next half hour or so is come up with some random process that generates realistic-looking networks. So we've done something a little bit similar before back in week 3 when we talked about network modularity. So there we wanted some random process that maybe split networks up into communities or something like that. We wanted to say, is this network more community-like than a random network would be? So that gave us a very simple probabilistic measure or a very simple hypothesis test that could allow us to say, do I think this network is community-like? In other words, is it more community-like than a random network? So one reason we want to have a good random model of networks is it gives us a good null model. So we can say, is this network somehow different from some trivial random model of a network? Another reason you'd like to have a good random process to generate realistic-looking networks is maybe you'd like to simulate or sample from the space of social networks. So, I don't know, maybe you're working for Google and you'd like to write some academic paper or release some network data set. You can't release the real Google Plus social graph, but maybe you can generate something with similar statistical properties that people could use to benchmark their algorithms. Or, you know, maybe you could actually extrapolate. So you could say, well, Google Plus looks one way with a billion users. How would it look if it had 2 billion users? So if you have a good high-fidelity random process of how social networks form, maybe you can simulate larger ones. You could stress test your algorithms. You can do hypothesis tests. You can do whatever you like. All of these things depend upon having a good model of how networks form. And, you know, more basically, we'd actually like to talk about or reason about, you know, what is the underlying process that causes people to form friends with each other? Can we come up with a process that is high fidelity in the sense that it generates realistic-looking networks, and therefore can we argue that we've kind of captured what's really going on when people form friendships? All right, so that's kind of some high-level motivation of why we would like to have a model that simulates realistic-looking random networks. So the first model we'll come up with is kind of a silly one, which is just say, let's build a graph that has n nodes and form connections completely at random. So this is one way that you might build a social network. You sign up for Facebook, and then you take all the 6 billion people on it, and you just randomly pick 100 of them. Those are your friends. Okay, that's one way that social networks could be formed. It's perhaps not very realistic, but in order to claim that it's not realistic, we'll have to analyze it and say, why is that different from the way people really do form friendships? So all that's going on is that we just throw down n nodes, and then for every possible pair I and j, we flip some coin, lands on heads, probability p, and if it lands on heads, we make an edge. If it lands on tails, we don't make an edge. Do that for every pair of possible edges. So if you wanted to generate a graph with exactly, or on average, E edges, you choose P is equal to E divided by N choose 2, the number of possible edges there could be, and an expectation this will generate a graph with E edges. So this is called the Oehlisch-Rainey random graph model. It's that same famous mathematician who studied networks. Obviously, the model itself is not very complicated or worthy of being named after two people. What's interesting, of course, is the analysis of it. So what's really going on? Not very much. You're just dropping a bunch of random nodes, and you're just flipping a coin for every pair, forming edges between them, No particular rhyme or reason. So here's an example of an Oetisch Rainey random graph. This graph has, I think, 100 nodes, and the probability of a node forming an edge, or the probability that any two nodes form an edge, is 0.01. Okay, so on average, every node has degree 1. I guess in a graph with 100 nodes, there are 100 choose 2, which is 4,950 possible edges. So this is going to have something like, you multiply that by 0.01, it's going to be 4,950 edges in this graph. So now, you know, these have, you start with a graph like this, and these have just been redrawn so that the edges are short, so that it's a nice visualization. But this is basically, after moving the nodes around, this is just a randomly generated graph. So does it look like a social graph or not? Is there anything about this which is really different from a small Facebook? Okay, many people are not connected, so I guess that's not true of Facebook. But imagine a Facebook where you could only form connections to your best friends, right? So imagine a Facebook where the average degree was 1. Would this be like, would it then look like Facebook, or is there still something that's kind of not Facebook-like about it? I mean, I mentioned a few properties right at the beginning that social networks have. Which of them is kind of violated? You know, someone said small world, and that's a good one. So I said that in social networks, there are always short paths between people. You can get from anyone to Kevin Bacon, just a few hops. It's not true here. Like, it's super not true. There's a distance between this node and this node is really, really, really long. It's much longer than the distance would be between any two people on Earth, even though Earth has 6 billion nodes and this only has 100 nodes. So paths way, 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 way longer in this network than they would be in a real social network. Anything else? Well, maybe there's one that I haven't mentioned yet, but there's a sort of simple structure that this network doesn't have. It has no triangles. So there's nothing to say it couldn't have a triangle. It's a randomly generated network. It just didn't happen to have any triangles. But somehow in this kind of random graph model, triangles are pretty rare. Whereas in a social network, triangles are very common. If you're good friends with two people, they're probably also friends with each other. So something like triangles closing is a property that this network doesn't have. One more property. Do we have power laws? Like I said, social networks exhibit power law-like degree distributions. There are a few people who have loads of friends and loads of people who have few friends. In this network, I don't know, maybe. We'll have to do some math to find out. All right, so a question then is, do these look realistic? We have a few reasons why they might not. But maybe one we couldn't figure out just by staring at it was, does it exhibit degree distributions like real networks do? In other words, does it follow these kind of power law structures? So what's the probability that a node has a particular degree? So what's the probability that node V forms K friendships? It's a pretty simple expression. There are N minus one people you can be friends with. You can be friends with everyone but yourself. And you're going to choose K of them. So there are N minus one choose K ways you could form K friends. And to do that, you're going to flip this coin, lines of heads with probability P. So you form K friends, and you form N minus one minus K non-friends. And it's just a binomial distribution. We remember this from high school, right? So that's the probability that a node would form K friends. So what does this distribution look like for large graphs, and is that similar to a power law? So that's just your binomial expression. Our question is is this similar to what a real network would look like as n becomes very large? So as I fix the number of friends people form, so I say everyone on Facebook has, I don't know, 500 friends, but I increase the size of the network to infinity, or at least a very large value. What does the shape of this curve look like, and does it match what the shape of node degrees in real networks looks like? So what is the limit of this expression as the size of the network grows very large? Okay, so I won't do the proof. I try to do the proof and I always mess it up and it'll take me 20 minutes anyway. But you take this binomial expression, you say what happens is the network grows very large, but the number of friends people can form remains constant, and it gives you an expression like this. This is really, it's really not a very difficult proof. All you've got to do is use this, what's called Stirling's approximation, which says that as n grows large, the factorial function looks like this kind of exponential function. Substitute this into this, mess it up a bunch of times and eventually get it right, and you'll end up with something like this. Okay, not too shocking. Anyone recognize this expression? Here's the hint. It's called the Poisson limit theorem. This is called the Poisson distribution. Okay, so you take your binomial probability here, you set n to be very large. That's going to look like a Poisson distribution. So here are some plots of a Poisson distribution, which has parameter lambda. So it's the probability the node would have degree k. You know, it's some sort of curve which is centered about lambda. So the question is whether that's realistic. So really, we have this value for the degree. The average degree is n times p. So n minus 1 times p, you connect to everyone else in the network, the probability p, and we've sort of shown that this has this shape that looks something like this, which is a Poisson distribution whose mode is equal to the average degree. So, you know, the average person has 500 Facebook friends, and that's also the mode of the distribution. There are not so many people who have less than 500. There are not so many people who have more than 500. The question is whether that is realistic. So that's kind of the main thing that was proved in this paper by Odish and Rainey back in 1960. They proved a bunch of kind of more obscure things, which I'll just kind of run off. So if the average person were to form less than one friendship, then this graph would almost surely have no connected component larger than log n. I don't know if anyone cares about that. If everyone forms on average one friendship, then you'd expect to have a giant component of size was equivalent to n to the power 2/3. Who cares? I don't know. I guess the more interesting one is if on average people form more than one friendship, then we would expect this random graph model to generate giant components. So those are two things they proved in this paper, really, that I think we care about. One is if you form this random graph model, nodes are going to have Poisson distributed degrees. And two, if nodes form more than one friendship on average, we're going to end up with one single giant component, which is certainly what Facebook has, right? And they prove a bunch of other obscure things that are not so interesting. So this idea of having a giant component, that's pretty realistic. So we talked about that when we did community detection. We said, why wouldn't you just run connected components on Facebook? Because Facebook's basically one huge giant component. If you have two components, all it takes is one person to form a link to connect them. So basically, everyone is connected. And yeah, real networks pretty much always look like that too. So this is kind of the structure of the web graph that somebody crawled in 2009. So they found that it has about a third of web pages belong to this giant, strongly connected component, where given any pair of web pages, you can reach one from the other and the other from one by following some bunch of links. There's about another third that link into this giant component but don't receive any links from it. There's about a third that receive links from the giant connector component, but don't generate any links back into it. And there are all kinds of other funny things, like there's a few disconnected components. I guess these are the dark web or something, right? And there are kind of these tubes and tentacles where they, you know, they connect from this in component to the out component without ever going through the strongly connected component. So I don't know. I mean, this paper was very splashy because they sort of said the web looks like a bow tie with some tentacles or something like that. I mean, any network must look kind of like this. It must have these parts. You know, it must have a strongly connected component. It must have things that go into and out of the strongly connected component. It must have other components. It must have tubes, and it must have tentacles. What was interesting about this result is that almost everything belongs to this sort of bow tie. Almost everything belongs to this giant component, and there's hardly anything that's sort of wholly disconnected from the web. And that's kind of true of a whole bunch of other types of networks besides the web graph. You know, it's true of citation networks. They have this giant weakly connected component. It's true of collaboration networks. It's true of people who talk to each other on Wikipedia, so on and so forth. So social and information networks definitely exhibit this property that almost all nodes belong to one giant component, just like our random graph model does. But on the other hand, this idea of Poisson degree distributions maybe isn't so realistic. So real networks exhibit degree distributions that look something like this. So this is what's called a power law, which is basically a straight line on a log-log graph, which really just says that there are a few nodes that have very high degree and a lot of nodes, or sort of a long tail of nodes, that have low degree. So if you've not seen a log-log plot before, basically all that's going on here is that you have, you know, different powers on both the x and the y-axis. And then the plot looks basically like a straight line. If you drew that on a regular axis, which was, I don't know, 100, 200, 300, 200, 300, it'd look something like this, right? So it's saying there's kind of the 1% who have all of the degrees, and then there's the long tail of people who get the leftover degrees. You know? So real-world networks kind of look like this, whereas what we have, and this is called the power law, so this is just a simple parametric function that generates things that look like that. So all of these real statistics of the network can be approximated by this straight line, which is basically the degree to some negative power. So real networks look like this, which is maybe somehow different from our Poisson distribution. So real networks look something like that. Our random graph model that we have so far looks something like that. So this is real. And this is Erdős Rényi. So somehow our random graph model is not very realistic yet. It doesn't exhibit the correct degree distribution structure. So at least it's not realistic for things like social networks. Maybe it's realistic for something else. So you can imagine something like a network of flights, or, you know, connections between airports is going to exhibit a power law structure. In a sense, there's a few very important hubs that sort of send and receive almost all of the flights, versus some much larger number of very obscure tiny airports that only have a few flights per day. So if you have a network that exhibits these kind of hubs, that's going to exhibit a power law structure. What would be more like Poisson distributed, I guess, is something like a road network, where there's just a very hard bound on how high the degree can be. You know, you can't really have intersections of degree 20. I mean, you can imagine some very complicated interchange, I suppose. But what's going to happen in a road network is there's going to be some small average degree, like 3 or 4, and there'll be fewer things with lower degree, and there'll be fewer things with very high degree as well, because high degree is just impossible in a network like this. So, you know, maybe, I guess I have to analyze, but maybe our Oder-Schrödinger random graph model is more like this one than it is like this one. It's definitely not like this one. But can we come up with a random graph model that somehow does exhibit this power law structure? In other words, a random graph model that does end up with a few hubs and a lot of nodes that have very low degree. So, what we want is a random graph model. We want to come with this notion of hubs plus this long tail of nodes with low degree, which can essentially be characterized by saying nodes are likely to connect to high degree nodes. So you're more likely to form connections with a hub than you are with some other random node, versus the Oder-Schrödinger random graph model where we just formed edges completely at random without thinking about their degree. So we'd like to come up with a random graph model that says a node is likely to form links with nodes that already have high degree. So here's a very, very simple process, which is going to be used to generate something like the web graph. We'll just lay down all of our web pages, 1 through n, and for every single page as we create it, it's going to just generate one outgoing link. So with probability p, it'll just generate a link completely at random, like our Oder-Schrödinger model did. Probability 1 minus p, it'll take that random link and then follow its link. Okay? So this is our model of the web graph. So it's a bit of a funny model. We can kind of just draw what's actually happening here. So imagine you have some bunch of web pages, 1 through n. Each of them gets to generate one link, so there's not much the first page can do. It's got a link to the previous one. Now the second page, I mean page number 2, can either form a link at random, or it can form a link at random, then follow that link. So let's say it just randomly connects to this page. The third one maybe randomly connects to a page and then follows the link. The fourth maybe just does the same kind of thing. Maybe this one forms a new random link. This one follows a random link. You can kind of repeat this until you get bored. Alright, so you either form a link at random, or you form a link at random and then follow the link. So everything has out degree equal to 1. Every page generates exactly one link, but there's no bound on how large the in degree can be. A page can receive as many links as it wants. So this is kind of a realistic way to form a web graph. You know, there's a budget for how many links you can have on how many outgoing links you can have on your web page, just because the web page is only so long. But there's no budget to how many links you could potentially receive, right? Of course, if you want pages to generate more than one link each, you could just repeat this process a few times. So what's really important is this step, which says sometimes we don't just form links randomly, but we follow the link that another page has already created. So what this is going to do is capture that idea we wanted, which says we're more likely to generate links to pages that already have high degree. So we could rewrite this expression as probability that you link to some page I is just proportional to I's degree. So you're more likely to form links to pages that already have lots of links. And this is kind of exactly that intuitive notion of the rich getting richer. The page is likely to receive links if it already has a lot of links. And we've come up with some very simple model of network formation that kind of captures that intuition. So I won't go through the proof, but there's a nice proof in a paper from about 10 years ago that if you run this random graph model, it's going to exhibit these types of power law distributions. So if you run a model that exhibits this rich get richer phenomena, you're going to get a Powell or an in-degree. So you're going to get a few web pages that have receive all the links and a lot of pages that receive hardly any links. So specifically if C is a function of P, you get some Powell or curve like this one. All right, so that's just sort of two simple models of network formation, one that exhibits power laws and one that doesn't, and kind of argued that power laws are realistic things in social networks, so the latter model of link formation looks more social network-y than this random graph model. Coming up with good models of random graphs is its whole own topic of academic study. This is another way of generating networks with power law degree distributions. You take some simple little network template that just has four nodes, and you apply this kind of what's called Kronecker multiplication to this matrix, which gives you this sort of fractal structure like this. And for each of these points, you flip some coin in probability P and form links like that. So you kind of get little hubs down here, and then you get sort of super hubs and super, super, super hubs. So you have this sort of recursive structure in the network that's going to exhibit this Powell or degree distribution. There's this whole topic of research of trying to come up with random graph models that mimic what real-world social networks look like. So we've just seen a couple, one of which is just generating links at random, which is the Oerdos-Renyi random graph model, and the other one, which is called preferential attachment, which says we prefer to form links to nodes that already have lots of links. And we're sure that this random graph model is at least realistic in terms of these giant components, and this preferential attachment model exhibits things like power law distribution. So we'll see on Wednesday. It's not quite the complete picture. This preferential attachment model, for instance, doesn't capture things like the number of triangles that a realistic network would have. So it's still not quite like a social network, even though it exhibits power law degree distributions. Okay, so just to finish up this segment about random graph models is something kind of fun. So what are some consequences of having a graph with a highly imbalanced degree distribution? So you may have noticed in your life, maybe you've been depressed about it, you may have noticed that it seems as though your friends have more friends than you do. It's not because you took any wrong turns. It's not because you're a computer scientist. It's just a statistical property of networks, okay? So I'll put your mind at ease. I'll hopefully make you a lot happier and tell you that, this is true on average for everyone. It's just how networks look. It's your friends have more friends than you do. Your coworkers have more citations than you do. Your sexual partners have had more sexual partners than you have. So you didn't go wrong. That's just how networks look. So let's try and prove that. And the proof is, it's very simple. It's kind of an unintuitive result. We try and do two things. So we say, let's calculate the average degree of a node. That's very simple. We'll just sum over all nodes, compute the degree, divide by the number of nodes. And secondly, let's try and calculate the average degree of a friend. So we'll sum over all edges and say, what is the degree of the first node in that edge? So it kind of seems like we're doing exactly the same thing twice, but magically, we're going to end up with two different numbers. And that'll kind of hopefully intuitively explain the result. So average node degree, very simple. Sum over all nodes U, the degree of U divided by the number of nodes. Okay, just average degree. So this would be equivalent to twice the number of edges divided by the number of nodes. So why is it twice the number of edges? Well, I'm adding up all the degrees of the nodes. So I count the start of each edge and I count the end of each edge at some point when I'm computing the two nodes' degrees. So it's as if I've encountered every edge twice. So computing the average degree is just the same as doubling the number of edges dividing by the number of nodes. Are with me? Nothing too shocking going on. So we'll just call that mu. That's the average node degree. The second thing is kind of the average degree of a neighbor. So rather than enumerating all of the nodes and computing the degree, Now we're going to enumerate all the edges and compute the degree of the first node in that edge. So we will sum over all edges, UV. We'll compute the degree of U. Forget about it. Sorry about that. And we're going to do that for every edge twice. So we end up going over every edge U to V, and we also do the edge V to U. So we do it in both directions. So every edge shows up twice. So this is the average degree of the first node in an edge for every edge in the graph. All right, so we're enumerating over all the edges twice. So another way of writing down the same thing would be to say, rather than iterating over all the edges, let's iterate all over all the nodes U, and then all of those nodes' friends V. So it's just another way of iterating through the edges by sort of expanding this sum to be over sum over U, and then sum over friends of U, so we call them V. I apologize for my handwriting. I know there have been some complaints. I'll try and do better. And then that's still just the degree of U divided by twice the number of edges. Okay, so I've just expanded this sum out into two terms, all nodes U and all friends of the nodes U. Then I'm just still adding up the degree of the node U. So this summation depends only on V. This expression depends only on U, so I can bring it out the front. And what does that look like? It looks like the degree of U, sum over V, friends with U of 1. Okay, so all I did was just pull this expression from here to here. If I'm summing up 1 for all of U's friends V, what does that expression come to? It comes to the degree of U. So really, all of this is just equal to the degree squared. You all with me? If you're not, I'm sorry, because I erased everything, but I guess you can look through it later. So these expressions are similar, summing over all edges and counting the degree of the first node is going to be equivalent to summing over all the nodes and counting the degree squared. Now this expression looks somehow reminiscent of something like the variance of the node degree. So we can write down what is the variance of the degree of U, and that would be equal to the sum over all nodes of the degree of U squared divided by the number of nodes minus mu squared. So, you know, we remember our expression for the variance. It's equal to the variance of some variable is equal to the expected value of the variable squared minus the expected value of the variable squared. Yeah? This is E of x squared minus E of x squared. So with this formula in mind, we can rewrite this expression in terms of the variance. So that's going to be all equal to the variance of the degree of U plus mu squared times V on twice the number of edges. Okay, so I've just sort of subbed all of this into this expression here. You can think about why these two things are equivalent. It's nothing too complicated going on. I've sort of moved this over to the right. Multiplications happened. You get the idea. So here we had an expression that looked like 2e on v. Here we have an expression that looks like v on 2e. So it's just the inverse. This term here is just 1 divided by mu. So I can get rid of it and just divide everything by mu. And I end up with the variance of the degree divided by mu plus mu. Okay, so what were my two expressions? I had the average degree is equal to mu, and average degree of one of your friends is equal to mu plus variance in terms of the degrees divided by mu. Okay, so obviously the variance is a positive expression, so this expression here must be greater than or equal to this expression here. So the average degree of your friends is greater than the average degree that you have. And how much it is greater than is going to depend on the variance of node degrees. So the only way these two expressions could be equal would be if the node degrees had variance zero. The only way the node degrees could have variance zero is if you had a regular graph, so every single node had exactly the same degree. The more variance there is in the degree distribution, the more this property is going to be true, the more it's going to seem as though your friends have more friends than you do. So I've said that in social networks, we have these power law-like degree distributions. So this is a distribution that exhibits incredibly high variance in the degree of nodes. We have a few nodes have very high degree, a lot of nodes have very low degree. So when you have something like a power law distribution in your node degrees, this number is going to be much, much bigger than this one. You know, an intuitive way of explaining this is just to say people with lots of friends just show up in more people's social networks. So lots of people are averaging over that one character who has loads and loads and loads and loads of friends, but few people are averaging over the unpopular people. So when you're comparing yourself to your friends, well, the highly popular people just show up more often precisely because they're highly popular. Nothing to be ashamed of, okay? All right, so that's about all I wanted to say about random graph models. I think since we're getting a bit short of time, maybe I'll stop there and talk about the second assignment. I know it's exactly what everyone's just itching to hear about and is planning to get started on it right away. All right, so I know you're not going to start assignment two until assignment one is already due, but you should at least start thinking about it. So start forming a team, start collecting data, start thinking about what applications, sort of from the second half of the class, interest you, what you'd like to solve, so that you can hit the ground running once assignment one is over. So I've moved the due date back. I've given an extremely generous one-day extension. Somebody pointed out to me this American holiday called Thanksgiving, which I guess occurs right before the assignment was originally due on the Monday. So now you have all of Monday, you have all of Tuesday, you can submit it Tuesday midnight. You know, it takes a long time to mark these things, so we don't want to push the deadline back. I mean, maybe there'll be a way of submitting it late for some penalty in grades, but, you know, worst case, if you really don't want to start it and want to celebrate Thanksgiving with all of your team, or your family, then you can still do the assignment on Monday and Tuesday and be in reasonably good shape. So all the submissions are going to be made electronically with this online form. Should be easy. There's kind of five tasks. It's worth 25 marks. Each of these tasks is going to be worth 5 out of 25. You want to find a good data set to study, look at some of its basic properties, come up with a good predictive task, and come up with features that are going to be useful to solve that predictive task. Describe some various models you'll use to solve it. They don't have to be new ones. They can be ones we've seen in class, but you would at least want to justify your decision to use one model over another, for example. You'll want to do some kind of literature review to explain what people have done with similar types of models, what people have done with similar types of data, and finally, some kind of analysis of the results you obtain. Okay, so, you know, the length is reasonably flexible. I give out some template and say something on the order of 4 pages in this LaTeX template format. In practice, no one ends up using LaTeX and no one ends up using this format, but it's kind of a very dense double column 10-point font or something if you were just to do regular old 12-point Times New Roman, more like 8 pages or something. So, you know, a couple of pages for each of these five tasks or something like one page for each of them in this very dense format that I give you. Teams of three, you can do a team of four if you really want. I think it's kind of tough to orchestrate a team of four given a relatively short period of time, such that one person doesn't end up doing everything or one person doesn't end up doing nothing. So, you know, if you really want to do a team of four, go for it, but just make sure you get started early. You can also have teams of one or two if you like. There's no difference in the marking scheme. Up to you. Okay, no teams of five. So, first of all, you've got to find some data set to study. You don't have to come up with a new one. I give out a bunch. A lot of people like doing stuff on beer and wine. Me too. It's a lot of fun, and these are very sort of high quality, nicely curated data sets. And like I said right at the beginning of class, they happen to be very dense in the sense that people rate lots and lots and lots of beers, and beers receive lots and lots and lots of ratings. So you can actually develop very rich models of individual user preferences and things like that. Wine's also fun. Google Local is kind of a more open-ended, ambitious data set. It's one I sort of half put together, and it's still a total mess, and you've got to do a bunch of pre-processing on it, and it's absolutely massive. But a few people always try and use that because it's just huge and huge and has loads of information in it. I guess I talked about Reddit submissions at the beginning of class. I'm back in week one or two. That data's also all available. There's social network data from things like Facebook, Google Plus, and Twitter. And, you know, there are other websites that other people have put together collecting all sorts of different kinds of data. Something a lot of people like to use is the Yelp Challenge data set. So this is a public data release that Yelp made. They run a competition every year with a $5,000 prize. It was won by a couple of UCSD undergrads last year. It's essentially a very nice data set of ratings and reviews and check-ins and geolocations and social network information and timestamps and all kinds of things. So you can build all kinds of different recommender systems type models with data like that. You know, use any of these data sets. Use any data set you want from any other source you like. Try to use something that's reasonably big, like 50,000 data points or so. There are always exceptions to this. Just come talk to me during office hours if you want to use a very small data set because it happens to be exactly the research problem you're already working on and you'd really like to do it for this class. Certainly bonus points if you try and collect or scrape a data set yourself or use something that nobody else is using. And then, yeah, it's totally fine if it's smaller than my minimum required threshold. Just as long as it's large enough that you can actually do some realistic analysis of it. And sort of the rest of part one, other than just finding a data set, is to do some exploratory analysis. So I don't know if it's a recommender systems type task. How many users, items, entries are there? What's the time period it covers? What's the range of geographical values? Whatever you like. Essentially, you want to come up with some kind of high-level intuition about why the features that are present in your data ought to be useful for the predictive task you want to solve. So this is kind of the high-level analysis I did on this Reddit data, where we said maybe we want to predict something like whether a Reddit submission is going to be successful or not, and we'd like to use information like the timestamp of the submission or what communities it was submitted to. And the first step is just to run some very simple analysis, basically generate some plots. Here's just a function of Reddit votes over time for different communities. And you can see, yeah, there seems to be some kind of periodic behavior going on. Therefore, you can conclude that a good model ought to capture some kind of temporal component. And here we can see what's the probability of a submission being successful if it was submitted to one community followed by another. And it seems to be that, I don't know, I forget what the result was, but if you submit to the same community twice, it's very unlikely to be successful. But you can steal content from an unpopular community and post it to a popular one, whatever. The point is, it's kind of, you're gathering evidence that there exists some temporal pattern and there exists some community or inter-community pattern that could be useful for predictive tasks. So you're kind of justifying why does it even make sense to model temporal information or to model community information for a predictive model of this data. So Second is come up with the predictive task itself. So, you know, how would you assess the validity or the significance of whatever predictions you're making? Did you have to pre-process the data to do that? So some of the data sets I gave you can just use as is. Some of them you've got to really pre-process them a lot to actually extract any meaningful signal from them. And really the important thing here is you did the exploratory analysis in part one. How does that justify a particular choice of features for the predictive task you want to solve? Third, come up with a model. I mean, you don't have to come up with it yourself. It's not compulsory to invent something. You can just use a model from class, but you have to justify your decision. So you have to justify, if you're doing a classification task, why is this particular model with this particular error measure the appropriate model to use? Of course, you should be comparing different models. You should be comparing different feature representations. You should come up with baselines to prove that your model that includes geographical or temporal information would be better than a model that didn't include those things, for example. And if you're working with a large data set or a complicated model, you should be explaining how do you actually implement this thing? How did you optimize your complicated model? How did you scale it? What did you do with overfitting, missing data, noise, outliers, whatever you like. Literature. So, you know, describe what people have done with similar models, describe what people have done with similar predictive tasks, describe what people have done with similar data. There are always one or two people who come to me and say, you know, I couldn't do a literature review because my idea was too original. It's never quite the case, okay? So maybe your model is original, but I'm sure people have done things with the same type of data. Or maybe your data is original, but I'm sure people have done things with similar modalities of feature, or they've done things with similar types of optimization. You know, there's always something you can talk about. And you can always talk about how the literature influenced you to use certain types of feature or to choose a certain type of model, even if the influence is determined after the fact. This is probably the last section most people write, including myself. So finally, you want to do some analysis of your results. So you considered a bunch of different models. You considered a bunch of different feature representations. Which of them worked? Why didn't they work? What happened that you didn't expect? What could you do differently if you were going to try and extend this idea? And you know, usually you're going to be coming up with some kind of learning algorithm which assigns weights to different parameters or something like that. So what can you say about what the model actually found out about your data? So if you have a model that incorporated all kinds of geographical or temporal features, what could you say about which times are very popular or which locations are very unpopular for a restaurant or something like that? So can you actually do some high-level, can you make some high-level intuitive claims based on the features that turned out to be useful? So one really quick example, I guess on Wednesday I'll talk about some of the cool assignments that people did last year. This is just an example I came up with. A couple of people attempted things that are very, very much along these lines. You know, you're welcome to follow this example exactly if you think it happens to be cool, but maybe you'd like to use restaurant data to figure out how people's tastes change as a function of, you know, the time of the year or the day of the week, or as a function of their geographical location. So, you know, I've given out this large Google Local data set which contains all of this information, like temporal information and geography. How can we use this to build a better recommender system? So we do some exploratory analysis. We'd say, how many users' items ratings are there? Which categories are popular or unpopular? Could we plot something like the geographical spread of users and items? Could we say, oh, well, are there certain geographical regions that just have a higher average rating than others? I don't know, do people give higher ratings to expensive or cheap things in different geographical regions or at different times of the year? Maybe they don't mind paying a lot of money on Friday, whatever. So you just do some high-level analysis of this data, which would kind of justify why you expect temporal or geographical information to be useful for some kind of predictive task. Second, you know, you try to come up with some predictive task. These are just a few examples. It could be what rating a person is going to give, like we've done in the assignment, which would be like a recommender systems type task, which could then be as a function of the time of year or the past ratings of the user or the geographic coordinates of the business. That would be a recommender system. We could do some kind of linguistic regression type task where we're trying to predict a binary outcome, like will a business succeed or fail based on its geographical location? You know, did this Chinese restaurant just open somewhere where no one wants a Chinese restaurant? And then, you know, you'll want to say, I guess really part three, what are the models and tasks that are going to be appropriate? And is there anything we didn't cover in class that you can draw inspiration from? And also you want to identify what are the features that are going to be useful. Okay, you have things like geolocation and I don't know, time or price, but it's sort of not trivial to, as we saw in the midterm, to convert these things into usable features. Something someone did last year was they ran clustering algorithms on the item locations and said, well, I'm not going to use the latitude and longitude coordinates directly, but I'll say that items that belong to the same cluster ought to be rated in similar ways or something like that. Okay, so yeah, you'll then say, okay, from that we can build a latent factor model. We'll use these features to incorporate a geographical term. Maybe we're saying that businesses that belong to the same cluster are rated similarly, or we'll use some kind of some complicated regularizer which says two businesses that are nearby ought to have similar latent factors, something like that. I don't know. There are all kinds of ways you could do this. And then how do you optimize this? You know, could you implement alternating least squares? Did you have to do gradient descent? How did you initialize your model because it's so horrible and non-convex? So on and so forth. Literature, so what have people done to predict ratings? What have people done with geographical coordinates? What have people done using, you know, temporal data to make long-term predictions? So on and so forth. So if not the model, then literature on similar data. And finally, what did he conclude from this? Does it help to use geographical information? Does it help to use temporal information? Did you discover some interesting factor like maybe people are more price sensitive in Southern California than they are in Seattle? I don't know. Could you sort of characterize the demands for a restaurant in a particular area? Like maybe you ought to open a restaurant where there are not too many competitors, but there also exists sufficient demand or something like that. So could you sort of do analysis of the parameters you learned of your model that kind of explain at a high level what's actually going on in your data? And, you know, finally talk about what worked, what didn't, and why you think it didn't work. So there's one more example, which I'll kind of, I think, let you read in your own time about trying to predict whether Reddit submissions are successful. And on Wednesday, I'll just cover a selection of things people did last year, but otherwise...
This has been a UC San Diego podcast. For more, visit podcast.ucsd.edu.